You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
Boys and girls, what is up? Welcome to episode 198. On this episode is a special guest and someone who in 2018 landed a spot on Forbes 30 Under 30 of Finance, Christina Chi. In her early 20s, after graduating from MIT, Christina and two classmates, Luca Lin and Jonathan Wang, who had collectively been trading futures from a campus dorm room, founded Domeyard. It was 2012, and Domeyard was to be one of the few high-frequency trading hedge funds. This is a little unique because the majority of HFTs operate as proprietary trading companies. As Christina states during the interview, by all means, we should have failed, given the three of them had little trading experience and minimal insight to the hedge fund industry. Not to mention the three had almost no money. So Domeyard is also one of the few hedge funds that went out and raised money from VCs, such as SoftBank and a Rentech co-founder, as a necessary means to launch. Now, 8 years on, the Boston-based fund is well established and well past the startup phase. Domeyard trades thousands of times daily, sometimes exceeding 10,000 trades across various futures products. And during its biggest single day this year, the fund did turnover in excess of $7 billion. This episode includes talk of raising capital, building infrastructure, early hurdles, trading strategies, generating alpha, and plenty more. It was a real pleasure to speak with Christina and even inspiring to hear what her and her team have built from scratch. It's just incredible. So please enjoy. Here is my interview with Christina Chi for episode 198. I understand it. You had been trading European futures in the night with two other classmates while you were in college or university. How did this turn into the bold idea of starting a hedge fund?
That's a really great question. We were trading from a dorm room, and it was interesting because we were surprisingly doing pretty well for a dorm room strategy, I guess. I mean, one of my co-founders, he was at Harvard at the time, and his roommate there, Harvard has all these rich kids apparently, and apparently one of his roommates, his family runs a hedge fund actually, and they were able to give us a little bit of capital initially to trade, and it wasn't a lot, it was like $100,000 or something, but we were able to make about $40,000, take home $40,000 basically at the end of the day, which was a lot for a bunch of little kids in a dorm room. And then we realized, oh, this could, for him, he was like, oh, wow, this could be, a really cool thing to do and would be really exciting, something that keeps you going and keeps you, waking up in the morning. And for me, the reasoning was more because I had interned in finance, and I had a couple of particularly, one particularly poor experience in the industry where there is a lot of politics, you know, despite being a trading floor and most of the results were based on, you know, you're judged based on your performance, but there was still a ton of politics, surprisingly. It's amazing how much politics is in every industry. So I was really bothered by the culture and the atmosphere there, the way they treated their younger people on the team, as well as some of the minorities on the team, some of the women and minorities, and I just didn't feel comfortable in that environment and ended up, you know, for me, that was a big part of the reason why I wanted to start off on my own. I don't think I've ever said that in quite that detail before, but there was a lot of hazing and a lot of behaviors that I just, you know, didn't want in a company and didn't want in a daily environment. So decided to start off on our own. You know, I wish I could tell you, Aaron, I wish I could tell you like, oh, this was the best industry for me. You know, I had researched and read so many books and did all this stuff. Like, no, I didn't. I didn't read any. I was not an expert in machine learning or high frequency trading or finance at all at the time. It was just purely driven by a desire to have a company with a better culture on my end and a better, healthier environment. And people always think it's ironic, you know, you're high frequency trading. Yeah, how can you be ethical and moral? And it's like, well, you know, we've had a really great environment for the people on the team, at least. And we can definitely talk about that more as well. So,
yeah. So you interned at a couple different places. You weren't a fan of this. You have two other co-founders at Domeyard. Did they have somewhat similar experiences to you?
We all came from different backgrounds. We actually weren't friends before starting the company together, but we did have one thing in common, which was the same career goals in mind. We all wanted to do something, you know, related to finance or fintech, and all cared about the startup industry as well. So we did have different backgrounds. So one of them had a more math and physics background, and the other one was a computer scientist. And but we were all young, we were all inexperienced. So it definitely, you know, was helpful in certain ways in that we had different skill sets and backgrounds, but also unhelpful in that our founding team, we didn't have someone like a thought leader in the space, you know, or someone with any amount of experience. So it was really an unknown path that we were kind of going down that we had never been down before.
Mm. So this capital, which you had initially that you were trading around with, how were you trading that? Were you using algorithms right from the get-go, or was it kind of click trading? How were you making trades in European futures?
That was a great question. I mean, we were literally using like interactive brokers. You know, we had set up some, you know, very wonky quantitative based strategies. They're still systematic. They still had certain triggers that we would use. You know, we might do a basic mean reversion strategy, you know, or a basic momentum strategy, just things that you can implement relatively quickly and easily. The holding, were we intraday? Yeah, we were actually intraday by that time already. But they weren't high frequency in terms of the amount of times they would trigger, you know, it's not that much during the day. So you know, it's impossible to create an HFT business overnight or in a dorm room. It's impossible. But we realized that the faster we were, the more of an advantage we would have. And surprisingly, the more fair of a playing field it was for us, which I know sounds ironic, but, you know, the fact that the only thing hindering us was just being a little bit faster, you know, and that we didn't need any, you know, we didn't need any insider information. We didn't need any you know, kind of broader sources of data rather than just market data. That's all we needed. And so that was really great to kind of see. And we decided, you know, why not continue making this, seeing what we can do on the technology side to improve the latencies we had. And back then, you know, we didn't even know. We knew it was high frequency trading, but this was before Flash Boys came out, by the way. So this is before the reputation of the industry tanked. So it was a different time period, you know, altogether. And we weren't driven by, you know, really anything that was written in the book because the book hadn't been published yet.
As you've pointed out, you had minimal experience trading and in finance. Like, yeah, sure, you had a little bit. You also weren't well capitalized, but you had this idea to launch a hedge fund. How did you actually set out to get this off the ground?
you're right, we had no money. I also had no credibility and no connections at the time, which was not very helpful whatsoever. By all statistics, by all means, we should have failed. I think we were just driven by passion, really, was the biggest thing. We woke up every day very early and set about doing this. And, you know, I'd work every waking minute. And that's really what drove me to get somewhere, I think. There are a couple things we did do differently to make sure that, you know, we would either have an edge or we could at least maintain some operating runway. One was raising venture capital, which for a hedge fund is still almost unheard of, but it's becoming a little more common. You know, there's funds like, you know, Quantopian, for instance, back when they had a hedge fund, you know, they also raised venture capital as well to fuel their unique fund. We've also done the same thing. We raised venture capital as well from some great folks in the industry who believed in us and wanted to maybe pass the baton or see what we were made of, you know, whatever it was. But that support was fantastic. It also gave us the credibility that we didn't have at the time, but, you know, desperately needed. So that was one way that we, you know, went about things. The other was building all of our technologies from scratch as well, which is both good and bad. I don't know if I could really recommend that to anybody today, because the world is a different place than it was even 5 years ago or 8 years ago. It's a different scene today in terms of what the technology landscape looks like. But there was not a lot of high frequency technology out there today. There was not a lot of open source either. So all we could really do is scrap it together, which meant actually the side effect of that is we have our own IP. We have a lot of valuable stuff in-house that we could always capitalize on one day, or, you know, maybe we could decide to sell it one day if we wanted to, you know, so that was really great. And also, if something goes wrong, we can go in and fix it ourselves. I don't have to call, you know, a hotline and wait on the line and stuff. So that was great. But the bad side, the downside of it is it takes forever. I mean, it was an unknown timeline, an unknown path and an unknown timeline, which is scary. It's like the last thing that you want to do is not know when you're going to launch, you know, as a hedge fund. And it's extremely frustrating. Happy to elaborate on that if you'd like to.
Yeah, I'd love to ask you some questions around raising capital and also building out your infrastructure. Just before we do, though, I have a question about why you were fixated on high-frequency trading from the outset.
I wanted to combine finance and technology and didn't even know what fintech probably wasn't a thing back then. But I have a more technical background, same with my co-founders. And, you know, during some of my internships, we would basically, you know, make guesses onto whether, let's say we'd guess whether Google stock would go up or down tomorrow. And I knew that wasn't the type of strategy I wanted to do. I wanted to be a little bit more mathematical. And, you know, that's when you figure out, oh, there's, you know, you could do some market making and stat R based strategies and have a more systematic approach to those strategies. And so that was the biggest impetus of doing, I guess, quant. And then when we were doing quant, we're like, oh, wait, you know, the faster, the more money we made. And I know that sounds like to some people, it's a really selfish reason. But that was really the biggest thing was, wow, we could really do this. And being faster, we could really start to compete against the big guys in our space and, you know, make a name for ourselves, hopefully one day. So that was the naive goal back then.
Okay. Now, on the subject of raising capital, I guess you kind of explained it a little bit, but I'll just ask you again. Why did you need to raise capital? And was that capital, like the investors' funds, were they intended for building out your infrastructure and building out the actual fund, or were those funds intended to be used as trading capital?
So I'll answer your second question first, which is this is meant purely for operations. So management company operations, like paying for employees, buying software, getting data licenses, paying for data feeds, you know, all those expenses that and legal fees and, you know, whatever service providers, any kind of expenses that lead up to the launch of the fund itself. I think the other thing is, like, if we could have raised enough money in the hedge fund on day one, maybe we wouldn't have to have, you know, raise venture capital to begin with and sell, you know, why sell a chunk of your company, right? That's a pretty risky thing to do. But we, you know, knew that on day one, given our backgrounds, we weren't even qualified or capable of raising enough money in the hedge fund. And so the biggest thing we needed to do, because we're high frequency trading as well, we couldn't just launch the fund overnight. We had to build we decided, you know, to build the order management system, feed handlers, execution gateways, you know, market engine simulators, like all those different tools pretty much from scratch. And so that was going to take a lot of time. And that's why we needed venture capital. We told them we were going to use it to build those technologies and then eventually, you know, get to a stage where we can launch the fund and raise a separate amount of money for the fund. The investors are actually largely separate. There is a little bit of overlap. There's some investors from, you know, like maybe firms like Renaissance or somewhere where they are both angel investors and also, you know, hedge fund investors too. So they might serve two roles. But for the most part, our hedge fund allocators are a very different group of, you know, they're fund of funds or family offices, very different group than the, you know, traditional VCs and, you know, other high net worth individuals that we raised from on the operating side. So, so we did do that. And then I forgot your first question.
you pretty much explained it. It was just, why did you need to raise capital?
Oh yeah. I mean, desperate. We were just desperate for money, right? In times like this, when everyone's in a crisis too, right? It's like, if you need the money, would I rather own 100% of a tiny pie, or would I want to expand that pie and own a small slice of a big pie? And I was like, well, for my career path right now, you know, I'm not that greedy and I'm just starting. So I was willing to own a small slice of a big pie if that meant stability for the next couple of years.
That's really interesting how there's kind of two classes of investors which are invested in your business. So you've got the venture capitalists, which were involved in helping to launch the business, and then you've got your more traditional type investors who are invested in your trading performance. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct. Yeah. Okay. So we had two different types of investors. We had the long-term venture capitalists who were in it for the, you know, it's like, feels like a marriage, right? Because they're in it for like the 10-year, you know, 6 to 10-year haul, basically. And then there's the kind of shorter term investors on the fund side where, you know, they could redeem anytime they wanted to, essentially.
Okay. Can I ask you how you secured your first investor? And investor here, I'm talking about the VC side of it. Given you had very little track record and, you know, to be honest, not much to show, how were you able to get someone on board?
On the venture side, it's actually easier to answer because the venture side, literally, you just go to the startup events and pitch, you know, at those events. Usually at the angel and seed stage, people invest in people, right? They shouldn't be investing in numbers like revenue figures because you shouldn't really have any. And if they do judge you by that, it's a very inaccurate indicator of future success because most companies, you look at like Twitter or, I don't know, Uber, you know, certain companies like that, they didn't have any revenue until much later on. And some of them haven't even, you know, a lot of firms haven't broken even yet, even though they've gotten millions, billions of dollars in funding. So it's based on people at that stage, which was great. But then when it came down to raising money for the fund, it was a different story. It's almost like separate strategy in terms of, you know, it was a little bit more about showing some numbers, and we couldn't really, because we didn't have any numbers at the time to really show for high frequency strategies. We had to really just do what we can. So like we would show like some back tests, for instance, and then have to have a ton of disclaimers about like, you know, here's, we only did one back test, you know, we don't overfit. We're not trying to, you know, show you the best one. And although most investors probably didn't believe it anyway, they're like, you know, they've never seen a bad back test before, right? So it's pretty much useless. But we still, you know, tried to explain our methodology. We explained what we were doing. We did offer day one investors more lower fees and higher control, so more liquidity. And that helped a lot too. And also, you know, higher communication channels in terms of maybe I would send weekly emails to certain investors so they would you know, feel more, I don't know, like feel better about, you know, what was happening or at least understand that, you know, what we were doing that week. And then, you know, obviously offering them a discount on the fees and lower, you know, better liquidity terms so they could maybe redeem at any point in time, maybe get rid of the lockup period, you know, things like that. That helped a lot. And one thing we realized is even if we got rid of the lockup period, you know, not a single investor redeemed, you know, within, let's say, 1 or 2 months or even within a year. Usually when an investor makes a decision like that, if they're a good allocator, they're in it for the long haul, but they just like having that free option available in case there's a pandemic, you know, in case there's some event where they actually absolutely need the liquidity. So, but yeah, that was really helpful from day one to kind of get that. And then there also, what's interesting, Aaron, is there also are, quite a few investors out there that particularly allocate to day one funds, you know, and they do expect the kind of lower fees, and they expect, you know, maybe a side letter or whatever. But, you know, the purpose is that they are interested in taking that risk with newer managers, and they might be interested, especially in the quant space. I would say a lot of they're interested in that new wave of quant managers who, you know, they view as kind of geniuses from a dorm room, basically. So hopefully people like us, and I wouldn't call us geniuses, but, you know, just folks from that kind of background, and give them a shot and see, you know, if they have that next big thing.
It might be a little bit hard for you to compare, but did you find there was perhaps some additional interest in your offering, given that there are very few funds out there which actually offer investors exposure to HFT strategies?
That's a good question. Absolutely, yeah. Especially, surprisingly, I would say after Flash Boys came out, that was when we got the most amount of interest, ironically. You know, there were a lot of allocators who had read the book, and they were like, wow, you know, let's Google this. What are the high frequency trading funds out there? And it turns out every other, the big high frequency trading funds, they all change their language on their website. Now they're, you know, they'll say electronic market making or low latency trading. You know, they'll try to get rid of that bad reputation and image associated with high frequency. We were the only firm that wasn't afraid at the time to just proudly say, look, we're high frequency trading. You know, I've never bought order flow or front run or back run, middle run, a single person out there. But we do high frequency trading. We're exactly the definition that you would expect of what high frequency trading is, because we're trading literally in the, you know, nanosecond resolution here, getting data at that, you know, at the high speeds, and then trading thousands and thousands of times per day. You know, recently, like this year, the highest we reached in terms of volume per day was 7.1 billion. So, you know, that is pretty much the definition of what high frequency trading is. And so we were doing that. We were like, well, we're HFT. So people Google us, we show up, you know, SEO, we would show up at the very top without really trying. And people would just reach out to us and be like, hey, you know, we heard about you. Can we schedule a phone call? So that happened as well after a certain point in time, and was relatively, you know, nice and helpful. I mean, obviously people would always have concerns like, hey, you know, what do you front run? And like, how do you handle order flow and things like that? And we would just simply say like, we don't buy order flow at all. It's just not the type of trading that we do. And we don't, you know, do what they described in Flash Boys, where they're blasting holes, you know, through mountains, under the river, whatever, to try to wire between different exchanges. Back then, you know, we literally were just trading within a single exchange, actually. So we didn't need the speeds between, you know, transatlantic cables or whatever. We didn't need any of that kind of stuff. So it made it a lot easier back then. And then, you know, over time as well, I think a lot of the myths in the book have been debunked or explained by folks over time. So most of the investors have gotten a lot more, you know, educated about our field, which has been helpful too.
I'd like to spend a little time speaking about how you built out the infrastructure. So you mentioned earlier that you built everything from the ground up, from scratch, internally. Is this unique for a HFT fund to do so?
I wouldn't say it's unique. It's something that, you know, especially if you're starting out in an industry that's relatively still relatively new at the time, or just hasn't quite been commodified yet. You know, it's something that you kind of just have to do to get up and running. I will say today, because after Flash Boys came around, actually there were a lot more startups that started doing HFT technology, you know, maybe like feed handlers for HFT, or, you know, thinking about open sourced kind of tools like that as well. So that has made it a lot easier to get to launch for a lot of folks. And usually today, when, you know, startups have a small budget, I just recommend look out there, see what you can use that's either, you know, cheap or free or open source. And surprisingly, there's a lot of stuff out there. you know, it's that, I guess, centuries old question of buy versus build. To be honest, it felt like we didn't really have a choice, but even if we wanted to buy, we couldn't afford it. So build it was on our end.
Right. I mean, yeah, it was probably a lot of cost up front and a lot of time spent, but does it feel like that's kind of optimal for you now? Like that's the ideal scenario is that you own all your own software now?
It's great today. It was really awful before we launched. I mean, you know, there were many frustrating days because we just had such an unknown timeline of like, we had roadmaps, we tried to map it out, you know, our investors demanded to see roadmaps and budgets and things like that. And we could try our best to do the roadmap. And then it felt like, I don't know if you know, like Zeno's paradox, maybe, I don't know. It was like one of those paradoxes we fell into where one task turned into two turned into four, and it just kind of grew. And, you know, you think a trading system sounds so simple, and then you look at all the nuances and details and all the data sets and every single nuance in every data set and just all this stuff. And it was quite a lot to deal with for, you know, a small team at the time. So yeah, it was definitely unexpected and quite frustrating, to be honest, before getting to launch. I think every company underestimates how much time it takes to get to launch, unless you're like, you know, if you're non-quantitative or if you already know what technologies you're using, then sure, maybe you can hook it up overnight and, you know, start trading. But even then, it still takes time. You got to set up the legal structure of the fund. You got to figure out, you know, who your auditors, administrators, et cetera, and they all have to be ready to turn it on with you at the same time, you know, so all those things combined made it quite a lot of work on our end and, you know, pretty frustrating 2.5 years before we got to launch.
Yeah. Now, this might sound like a bit of a naive question, but just for anyone who might not understand, what's the right word here, might not understand what goes into building an HFT business, which is probably a lot of folks, what did you have to build? Like, what took 2.5 years? What were all the different components that had to be developed?
There's so many. you know, it's like pretty much a type of, we had to build the entire trading system and ecosystem from scratch. So everything from, because we need direct market access, right? So we're literally placing trades ourselves at the exchange level. And so because of that, we had to build a system, you know, order management system, basically a system to be able to place orders, to see orders, to track orders, you know, to figure out what's going on, to cancel things. And that also included risk management tools that we had to get basically verified by all the different, you know, brokers, exchanges, et cetera. Everyone had to make sure that our risk checks were enough and that they were stable, and that if there was some, you know, a crazy event that happened, that you know, our systems wouldn't go rogue. And so we had different ways to check those types of strategies as well, to make sure that we didn't accidentally, you know, tank the markets ourselves single-handedly or make any big errors or mistakes on that end. So that requires quite a lot of work. It's very different from a tech startup, by the way. And that's one thing I've noticed was, you know, with tech startups, you can launch an MVP and it can be bare bones. It can be broken. It can be pretty bad. And that's okay. You know, your clients, early stage day one clients, should forgive you for that because they know you're a startup. When you're trading, it has to be perfect. You can't have any error, any room for error at that level, because you're literally, if you mess up, you know, you're done for. You don't have a second chance in this space. So that kind of process of making sure everything was perfect definitely took a lot of patience and, you know, energy and effort and a lot of, you know, checks, making sure all the checks, balances, whatever else, you know, was in place as well. Yeah, so that was a big thing. And then, you know, how do you process data, right? It's another big question of how do you get the data that we wanted? We had data directly from the exchanges, but then how do you process that data and turn that data into an actionable, you know, some kind of value that we could extract from it? And so how do you do that as well? You know, so that took a lot of time to figure out and to process and then, you know, data pipelines, they would always break. We would always have some kind of issue that happened. And so figuring out how do we timestamp that data, how do we process that data was also a big question that we would have in mind as well. Yeah, in general, it's quite a nuanced process, and it just had to all be relatively perfect on day one, or else, you know, no, hedge funds rarely get second chances, I would say, unless you're famous and your name is already known, and or you try to make yourself known. But back then we weren't. So, you know, we literally just had one shot and knew that we couldn't mess it up. So a little kind of scary, but we do feel fortunate and lucky to have made it this far today.
And saying that, what gave you the confidence, you know, after 2.5 years of building this out, that when it came time to switch everything on, what gave you the confidence that the strategies were actually going to be profitable?
Oh, man. To be honest, we didn't. It's hard to say. You can do as many back tests as you want. We had a simulator as well. We could simulate, you know, strategies and orders and fills basically in the live environment too, which was great. But even then, you know, it's hard to replicate 100% what's going to happen in reality. So we did as much as we could, test as much as we could. And then one day, I remember the first day we launched, we were just kind of like, you know what, screw it. Let's just trade. Let's just do it. You know, we got to take we were very risk averse at the time too. And we're scared, you know, to do something we've never done. And we're just like, you know what, let's just try it, turn it on, see what happens and hope for the best. And that's literally, you know, what we did. And thankfully things didn't blow up on day one. Thankfully nothing, you know, crazy happened. And we were like, okay, this is great. Actually, we could, you know, we figured out, you know, we needed that kind of feedback from the markets and we're able to fine tune the strategies even more and just continued going from there. So, but yeah, it was definitely a relief to finally have launched and to be able to tell people, okay, we finally launched. We're no longer, you know, felt like I was a fraud all the way up until we launched. And so we're like, oh, we're finally a real hedge fund, you know, and we can have a real track record to show people, which was fantastic.
You're in business. Yeah.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then they made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Just recapping those first few years, looking back on it, what would you say were some of the, you know, the breakthrough moments which you had and also some of the unexpected challenges which you came up against?
Oh, there's so many. I don't even know where to start. I would say like when we first started the business, we wrote down, you know, some of the things that we wanted to save money on and some of the things that we wanted to spend more money on before getting to launch, because we had such a limited budget, but there were some things that were worth, hopefully, you know, we thought were worth spending some money on, like a good lawyer is a good example, or maybe finding a good broker, you know, like someone with a reputation as well, auditors, et cetera. We could splurge on, and then, you know, things that we valued, like we wanted to be a flat organization. Back then everyone was called partner and, you know, see, and then it actually did not go too well. And I have so many reasons for that. And, we wanted to have perks almost like, I don't know, we're a bunch of naive kids, right? So we literally thought about like, let's make this like Google, like a Silicon Valley company with like free food and unlimited vacation and all these great perks. And we quickly realized like that those were both really bad ideas on the organizational side. You know, you don't want to call someone. We hired like literally like head of HFT from firms like Citadel and, you know, Getco back then and other firms, and KCG back in the day as well. And, they would come in and they'd be like, wait a second, you know, why do I have the same title as this kid who graduated, not, you know, not necessarily me, but like, what about this kid you just hired, right? Who just came out of school, you know, why is he or she called a partner? And we were like, oh gosh, you're right. You know, we realized that, people actually felt less equal because of that rather than more equal, which was pretty bad. And then, in terms of perks as well, just didn't work out. You know, people abused the perks like crazy and, it was kind of unfair, made it more unfair and gave people kind of almost giving people too much choice sometimes is a bad thing. So things like that. And then, you know, also splurging on things like lawyers and brokers and stuff, we realized quickly that it also wasn't worth it to hire just the biggest companies out there, you know, that it's okay to go for a smaller, as a small hedge fund, that, you know, it's okay, your investors aren't going to look down on you for hiring a smaller lawyer, you know, so long as they are still qualified to do their job, right? So just things like that, we made a lot of mistakes on. Trying to think of what else. We did so much wrong that it's just hard to even begin to imagine. So I'm just trying to think of what else there was. Oh, I mean, we had to settle. We started off in my apartment, actually, after graduation. We worked in my apartment for some time until we were kicked out. We were evicted. And the reason why we were evicted was actually kind of a random reason. Well, the cops knocked on my door late at night. But what happened was we had built our server cabinets literally in the closet of one of the, like, the master bedroom, basically. And we rigged our own electric, you know, basically we rewired the electric system and built our own box and stuff. And I think Jay Wang, one of my co-founders, he actually electrocuted himself in the process. So we were clearly not experienced at all. We should have hired a unionized, I don't know, person, right, to do this. So we were doing some pretty sketchy things. We ended up, you know, we're trading so much. We had so much going on the server side that we were literally using up all the electricity in the building. And you could also, you know, people thought that we were like, we had a marijuana farm or something. Like, literally people thought we were running some kind of marijuana farm. And so that's why the cops knocked on our door thinking like they were expecting to find us growing pot or something, or, you know, harvesting drugs, whatever it was. And they came in, they're like, wait, what is this? And they saw there's computers and monitors everywhere. And they're like, what? Are you guys some genius hackers? Like, they thought we're hackers. And we're like, no, this is, you know, this is a small business here. And, you know, I did live in the other bedroom. So technically it's my home business, right? And they were like, no, this is not going to work. You gotta get out of there and get a real office. And then the next day we literally packed up and moved to WeWork. Back when WeWork first opened in Boston at the time, our rent shot up. We used to pay $4,000 per month for rent. And then at WeWork, it was $12,000 per month. And so it's three times as much. And the room we were stuck in, you know, WeWork, they pack you like sardines in these tiny little rooms. And literally, it was the size of the server closet that we had at the apartment. So it was just, what a crazy, just a turn of events like that, that really changed the environment and stuff. But lots of adventures like that, that we were willing to go through. And, you know, finally, we're very lucky to finally get to a point where we could launch, I guess.
What a story. That's hilarious. if we look at Domeyard where it is today, I'd love to just ask you a few questions around kind of some trading metrics, if you will. So can you tell me how many trades do you average per day currently? Of course, it varies, but just on average.
Yeah. recently, 2,500-ish, a little under 2,500 trades per day, which recently has not been a lot. We've done more in the past, you know, depending on the market environment and stuff like that. But in general, it's up in the thousands, you know. And completely automated, you know, people are always like, are you really high frequency trade? Yeah, you know, this is high frequency trading, you know, they're all intraday, and holding periods anywhere between, I mean, I know this sounds like I'm not marketing and we're not fundraising. I'm just going to clarify that right now so that people don't, you know, SEC doesn't come after me again. As I'm just saying, we're not fundraising. You know, we are holding period wise anywhere between, you know, less the split second, you know, like less than a second, microseconds, all the way up to hours these days. And we consider the hourly, you know, holding periods, we call them midterm strategies, but to every single one of our investors, that's still high frequency to them, because mid frequency is like weeks. So days, you know, it's a different, we live in kind of different universes, it feels like a little bit, but yeah, happy to answer any questions as much as I can without getting in trouble.
Okay, so are you flat at the end of each day, like you don't carry anything overnight?
We are. We used to do some overnight stuff, but, you know, realized that our niche was still in the high frequency, you know, intraday type of strategies. And we also figured that the additional edge we would get from holding overnight it was mainly a constraint that we put on ourselves to be flat, but it's just something we've gotten used to over time. I would say there's really, these days we could technically do overnight strategies again, but it's just something that we haven't really done yet for various reasons of, you know, just profitability, risk, you know, all those different factors that we need to keep in mind if we did that.
Okay. That number you gave before, 2,500, I actually, for some reason, thought that number would be a bit higher.
Oh, yeah. It could be up to, I don't know how much, 10,000, you know, 25,000.
Okay.
It really depends on what we're trading and how the markets are reacting and how much, you know, what the liquidity profiles look like and all the other things like that, too. So, you know, sometimes it's just, actually, during the virus, you know, the volumes did shoot up quite a lot because there's, you know, lots of speculators, lots of day traders and a lot of institutions. Everyone's just very active right now. So it did shoot up a little bit. But for now, you know, it's down to the 2000s.
Okay. Are the number of trades you make, is that somewhat correlated to the volatility of the market?
Good question. Kind of yes and no, depends again on what kind of strategy we're implementing. You know, usually during very high volatile, you know, periods like this, basically, we tend to have a lot higher volume. The hope is that we perform better and can maintain some kind of neutrality to the markets. So that's definitely the case for, I would say, actually most high frequency trading firms as well, is just during periods of, you know, higher volatility. There tends to be just more naturally more opportunities out there for folks to see and utilize.
Right. And are you able to share your win rate?
I actually did not. That's one thing I did not ask the lawyers about. In general, I will say, you know, we're really happy with our performance this year. We did have like two very particularly disappointing months in general. But overall, you know, we're definitely still by a huge margin beating, you know, all of our benchmarks. So it's been a great time for us to, and also because it's, this is also the first recession we've been through too, because we didn't go through 08, I was still in school. So so the other thing is, because of this, we were able to prove ourselves and be like, ha, you see, we can finally show we've been through, you know, the ringer, we've been through this bad, these crazy times, and that we can show that we can, you know, go through those and more. So, you know, we've had some disappointing months, but in general, it's been all right.
Okay. And how about average daily turnover? Of course, that would vary with the number of trades, but just broadly speaking.
Oh man, just turning over so much. it can really add up to quite a lot. I mean, you know, we would trade like recently, again, like the most was 7.1 billion, I think, per day this year. So we've gotten quite high and substantial in terms of the volume and turnover rates. And it'll probably continue like that for hopefully for some time.
Right. And given that you're trading so much, and I don't know your win rate, but I presume it's, you know, above 50%. Are you profitable at the end of each day? Like, I presume a losing day would be pretty rare.
So we are not necessarily profitable at the end of each day. And I think that's something, you know, unfortunately, for us and maybe even for other firms as well, it's become a lot more common. Like, I know we read articles about Virtu, you know, not having a single losing day in years, right? And you're like, wow, is that standard for the industry? I'll say probably not. Most HFT firms, you know, we can end the day losing, you know, having a negative, you know, much less money than like the day before. That does happen as well. So, you know, the goal is though that we do aim for 100% winning days nonetheless. And, you know, when a losing day happens, that's okay. You know, we try to deal with it. Usually what happens on our end is like we might have 29 winning days and then one big losing day that just wipes out everything we made during those 29 days. Sometimes that kind of stuff, you know, does happen to all companies, all firms, but it's life, right? And we've learned to how to deal with those types of days, how to mitigate those risks and learn from those, you know, crazy experiences.
Okay. And now I haven't asked you what products you're actually trading. Like, what markets are you most active in?
Pretty much almost everything. We're not as active in, like, we're active in primarily US markets right now, but, you know, US equities is probably the one big market that we're not as active in at this point in time. We've traded before in the past, but, at this point in time, it's just not the market for us. Most of our strategies are concentrated in futures, And we have a lot of FX at this point in time as well. We do have some option strategies that we're utilizing at this point too. So a lot of Delta One strategies and not a lot of equities, although it's something that, you know, we've every year, every month we consider like, oh, maybe we should go back into equities again and try it out. It really just depends on the conditions and, you know, what we're testing. We're constantly testing things behind the scenes and figuring out whether or not it's the right time to pursue something.
Okay. And is that all futures in the US? Well, not all of them, but is it, or are you more focused on like indice futures or commodity futures or pretty much the whole mix?
It's the whole mix. Yeah. We're pretty agnostic within the future space at this point in time. They do have to be products that are, you know, relatively frequently traded, or else it would, you know, not be worth it for us to deploy a strategy within. So they're heavily traded products that we can hopefully take up, a chunk of the ADV, not a lot, maybe like, you know, aim for 1-3% of the average daily volume of that product. But we do look for things like that. But in general, we try to be agnostic in terms of sector.
Okay. Now, this might be a bit of a broad question, but just on your strategies, in such a highly competitive area of the market that you compete in, how do you seek to generate alpha?
In terms of generating alpha, there's a lot of different things to kind of keep in mind on the parameter side. So I think the biggest thing is figuring out what are some niche areas that we can really take advantage of. What are some products that, you know, we can kind of be able to map out and be able to make predictions on. So a lot of it's based on, you know, small predictions, maybe a few seconds ahead of time on where different trades and products will go. So that's a big portion of it. But then also looking at other, I'm trying to think of other things we do on this side. Let's see, just mapping out in general, hundreds of different signals and like finding the different signals that we can trade, mapping those all out. And then we actually do use a layer of machine learning as well to do some signal selection throughout the day as well. So figuring out, you know, what those signals are and what's going to make the most money during this certain environment. And then when the environment changes, you know, what kind of strategies we want to pull back and what do we want to deploy? So that's always a really tough question. But it's surprising because most HFT firms, you know, I would never say that we're an AI-driven machine learning-based firm, but we do use just a little bit to do some, you know, basic strategy selection type processes on our end.
What data drives the majority of your trading signals? Is it order book alone, like looking at the market depth, or is there additional input from other data sources too?
It's mainly market depth, yeah. So just order book data is extremely helpful for us. We do have a little bit of what we call metadata, you might call it alternative data in different types of areas too, whether that's usually it's like, you know, things like calendar data, right? Like every high frequency trading firm needs to know when bank holidays are and things like that. Or maybe things like SEC filings or big economic, you know, announcements or, Fed meetings, things like that. You know, that kind of stuff does need to be factored into, the strategy as well. So we can't just be completely focused on the market data, but we're just also keeping in mind all the other components of data as well. So yeah, in general, though, I think the biggest source is still, you know, just market data. That's the bread and butter we need to kind of survive. And then from there, you know, it's almost like a bonus if we can get other sources of alternative data that could help us out here and there as well.
Okay. Can you speak to almost like the strategy survival rate or the signal survival rate? Like, what's the edge decay like on these signals? Like, are you continually, you know, innovating and revising your signals, or do most of them kind of last for a long period of time? I mean, I perhaps didn't really word that question very well, but I think you probably understand what I'm asking here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the half-life of these strategies, you know, can be relatively short. It could be a month, 1.5 months, you know, and then within 3 months, the strategy is, pretty much almost worthless at that point in time. And so it's a process of constantly revising the strategies, a process of constantly finding new strategies as well, and modeling those strategies in different environments to see, you know, how they would do And then also figuring out why did the strategy die, and they could die for so many different reasons. You know, a lot of it's because competition has caught up, or maybe because the environment's changed and the, you know, signals that you're looking at just are no longer valid for whatever reason that happens too. So there's all kinds of different reasons, but it's just important to be able to figure out when it happens and why, and be able to move on quickly and not get too attached to one or two, you know, strategies. But you know, we have like hundreds and hundreds of different types of signals to potentially deploy and take a look at. So just making sure we're careful there. I know there's stories about, like, I don't know if you've heard, there's stories of like Renaissance, for instance, and other types of funds where, you know, when people leave their those types of firms that are doing really well, one of the biggest reasons why it's hard to spin out of certain, you know, successful HFT firms and to just do your own thing and be more successful is a lot of it's because they're constantly revising their strategies over at Renaissance as well, I'm sure. You know, when you steal a strategy, by the time you get to launch 3 months later, that strategy is already dead and it's just no longer effective. So that's definitely something that we do as well on our end, is just, you know, it's not on purpose, but just the nature of high frequency trading is just that the opportunities you find may not necessarily last for a very long period of time, and they might be really niche. So once we find it, and once that niche kind of goes away, then we're on to, you know, hopefully the next thing.
During the trading day, what level of human input or decision making is there? Obviously, the trades are all automated, but is there any human intervention during the trading session?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. Well, first, I will say, like, a lot of people have this vision of high frequency trading being, you know, a bunch of robots taking over the world, or, you know, machines and, you know, that are out of control with, you know, humans not being able to really understand what's going on in this black box. And that's really not the reality at all. You know, these trades are being heavily monitored and, you know, by humans throughout the day when we're trading. And, you know, really just gathering all kinds of data about what we're doing and stuff like that. There's a huge human, you know, obviously we're not having a human sit there and click to make those trades. You know, there's no, it's just being placed automatically. But there's always a human behind the scenes to tweak the strategies, or to tweak some parameters, or, you know, change some of the risk parameters, things like that. And a lot of it's in code, but just kind of changing that coding of what the strategy might look like. So yeah, there's a surprisingly large human element in terms of what we do. And, you know, the strategies also, they're only as dumb as the humans who are, you know, creating them. Hopefully as smart, but, you know, I always say that they're as dumb as the person who created it. So absolutely, you know, we need that human intervention constantly to make sure that nothing goes rogue or, you know, crazy. The other thing is, like, I'm trying to think of, you know, the markets as well, right? Because this isn't like a closed loop game. It's not like a game of Go or, I don't know, chess, where there's rules and everyone's going for the same goal. You know, in the financial markets, things are constantly changing to the point where even today, right, you know, we see a lot of things like oil going negative, you know, things that economically, like in your textbook, you know, you would never, it just makes no sense, you know, and that happens all the time. And a lot of that might be just, it's just driven by human, very human behaviors. And so you need to have a human behind the scenes to understand those behaviors in order for your strategy to do well. You can't just have a strategy that, you know, you can, you know, even if it's some kind of deep learning model, or, you know, if it's learning by itself from its own inputs and stuff like that, like that's great. But again, you can't quite model the financial markets. And we've seen startup after startup, you know, including Watson as well, you know, IBM Watson trying to model the markets with their ETF, and you look at how they're performing, and, you know, some, it's just not the best start to the ETF AI driven, you know, stuff. Yeah, absolutely. My personal opinion as a high frequency, you know, ironically as a high frequency trader, is that there is an important human element that, you know, we can't forget in behind the scenes.
Now, as you are a high frequency trading fund, obviously speed and reducing latency is a big factor in what you do. What measures do you take to reduce latency, both internally and externally?
You know, the biggest thing people always imagine is like, oh, you're doing, you know, what they did in Flash Boys, but we don't do any of that. you know, biggest things on our end is purely pretty much, you know, just internally making sure, okay, let's, you know, gather data the fastest we can. Let's make sure that once the data is in place, you know, between getting raw data and processing that and turning it into an actionable strategy, that we can reduce the amount of time it takes to be able to do that. and then also be able to run that strategy, you know, on live data and be able to, you know, place those trades as fast as you can. And for latency, it's basically, you know, as soon as we discover a decision we want to make, the time between that decision and actually implementing it, you know, that kind of that time we do try and reduce as much as we can, you know, whether that's just through direct market access, you know, with the exchange, or making sure that, you know, our order management system is structured in a way that is fast and efficient and can process, you know, a bunch of orders at the same time without having, you know, too much lag. I know we've had, we've had some, I know on the development side, like we'll maybe consider like, you know, even just things like shortening names of stuff might help a little bit too. So just making sure that our names are a little bit shorter so that computer wise, you know, it takes a little less time to process. So stuff like that might work as well. And then making sure that we optimize for different strategies on the latency side, you know, the strategies themselves. So making sure that we're optimizing on that front so that they can be, you know, code wise, right, to be a little bit faster and take a little less processing time in order to complete. So that's definitely important as well. I will say one other thing though is, you know, I know everyone obviously talks about speed and thinks about speed when it comes to high frequency trading, but on our end, I think we found our niche in terms of, you know, we're not trying to aim for being like the top fastest high frequency firm out there. And I think most firms are like that these days where, you know, we don't play the hardware game actually. So we used to, assemble our own hardware, buy the best thing out there. And then we realized every year they're going to release a better, I don't know, FPGA, a better, you know, piece of hardware somewhere out there. And do we really want to pay an extra $1 million? Is it really worth it? Or you just realized it just wasn't at some point, and there were lower hanging fruit in different areas. A big reason, by the way, is also because at the exchange level, if their latencies are slow and there's a lot of jitter happening at the exchange level, then even if we did place an order really fast, you know, the decay, there's still a little bit of a decay in terms of the timing it takes and the alpha that we end up getting. And so we were like, well, why don't we just figure out, you know, we call it lower hanging fruit in terms of maybe better signals or looking at better products out there that, you know, we could take more advantage of without having to compete at the, you know, microsecond level all the time. So thus, you know, going for strategies that are have longer holding periods as well and may not be, you know, what you would typically expect of high frequency trading, just trying to be fast, fast, fast.
Now, one of the things which I understand about HFT strategies is that they have capacity constraints. And that's what's kind of interesting about what you guys do is you are a fund where most traders who are running HFT strategies are mostly prop model, whereas you're a fund. And I guess that's one of the reasons is because HFT strategies typically have constraint capacities. How do you deal with that aspect of it?
That was a great question. It's one of the biggest things that keeps me up at night, actually, is, you know, HFT is, although people always assume it's this menacing thing, you know, we're not a scalable business. The industry is just not scalable given the nature of what HFT is, you know, and that's fine. I think that could be a fair thing. And, you know, it's just how things are. The capacity constraints, you know, the reason why we're a hedge fund to begin with was we didn't even have you know, $1 million or $100,000, you know, we were literally negative money because we were in debt. So we didn't have any money at the time to trade. And we supposed, well, you know, even if we could start a small fund in the meantime, it would be better than nothing and at least give us enough of a boost in our early stage careers to, you know, to know the industry better and also to hopefully, you know, learn a thing or two. So, so that was the big thing there. But, you know, if we could, like, let's say if we could start today, yeah, we would probably be a prop shop, instead of a hedge fund structure. Cause the hedge fund structure, you know, it's great in that, yeah, you have all these external investors coming in, you know, and that's good for us to get to know the industry better and to see what's happening out there and to meet some great investors. The bad part is obviously it's a lot of extra work, you know, to have to do the weekly, you know, sending newsletters out or sending emails and, you know, answering questions and stuff, but also regulatory wise too, you know, registering with all the different, you know, SEC, NFA, whatever other countries and jurisdictions that we want to be involved with. So that is, you know, just a lot of administrative work, costs you time and money. Having a director in the fund, you know, thinking about the legal setup of the fund structure, all this other kind of stuff. Like that costs surprisingly a lot of money even before getting to launch. and so that was kind of the trade-off that we had to make, I guess, in order to start the hedge fund structure.
Right. Now, Christina, just one last question before we close it out here. Is high-frequency trading as profitable as everyone understands it to be? I'm not sure if this is public information or if you're able to share it, but if so, are you able to share some performance numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say it depends on who you are, because some people imagine that HFT is just this money-making, cranking machine that never loses and stuff like that. And that's definitely not the case at all. It's a very it's fallible. It has issues, and that's the reason why a lot of HFT firms, that existed 10 years ago are no longer around today, right? It's because they still died for one reason or another, or they got acquired, or they just were no longer the profitability that they used to be. I think a good analogy, by the way, is like in the crypto space as well, where if you started a crypto hedge fund, back in 2012 or 13, yeah, maybe you were great, you're good. Congrats on being one of the, earlier funds, right, in that space. But if you started a crypto fund today, most of the alpha is going to be pretty much gone, so it's kind of a similar thing where it gets harder and harder to compete as more people flood the industry like that. But I will say, like, it was really surprising for me because we had spent 2.5 years literally making no money at all, which is, for any startup, that's extremely frustrating and, almost like heartbreaking to see. And then the day that we started launching the strategies and stuff, we were super nervous. And I remember turning it on and literally there was nothing. Like, we weren't trading at all and just nothing was happening. We're just waiting around the table, in our office, just huddled there being like, what's going on? Why isn't anything happening? And then we just kind of gave up by the end of the day. I just went to go grab, eat some ramen or something. And then someone called me over there like, Christina, it'll come back. It's finally starting to trade. And I was like, oh my gosh, the market's right about to close. And we literally started trading at the close and we checked our balance and we had made $70,000, in like a minute. And we were like, oh my gosh, that's more money than my parents make combined in a year, and that feeling of like, oh my gosh, have the tables turned, and hopefully we won't lose, hopefully we won't lose the money. But, that kind of feeling of, oh my gosh. And then thankfully that, continued for some time. And then we felt very just like, holy crap, the wait was worth it.
And what about like annualized returns, that type of thing? Are you able to share that info?
Unfortunately, I can't because we've gotten in trouble for sharing it in the past it's considered marketing it just does not go well with. We were audited quite extensively in the past couple of years or so. And this was always one of the things that they always get us on is they'll listen to the podcast and be like, oh, why did you say that? And why did you have this tone when you said it, and like, this could be construed as, marketing in one way or another. So unfortunately, we're not allowed to market. I would love to though, because I'm so proud of, what we've done. Unfortunately, we're not the type of fund that can market that kind of information.
Understood. That makes sense. I mean, the last thing you want is legal hassles. So totally understand. Christina, just such an amazing job. It's really inspiring to see what you and your co-founders have done and what you've achieved over the past, I think it's 8 or 9 years now. So, especially having started from scratch, like built everything from the ground up, it's just incredible. Awesome talking with you. I'm very grateful for your time. And I know we've been trying to set this up for a little while, so I'm glad we could make it happen. If somebody wants to find out more about you, I know you've given a few talks and that type of thing, which are available on YouTube. You're also on Twitter. Can you please share your Twitter handle?
Sure. It's just my name. It's at Christina Chi, which is spelled Q-I. Please feel free to check it out. I'm a little crazy on Twitter, which a lot of people don't like, but I think there needs to be more loud vocal voices in this industry. So, and hopefully I have some reason in terms of most of the stuff I say and am not just completely crazy like some other folks in this industry, which is fine, but everyone has a different personality. So feel free to check that out. And then also recently I've been working on a data venture as well. So if you guys are interested in market data and infrastructure co-location, that kind of stuff, you know, definitely feel free to reach out as well, because we do some really cool stuff on that front too.
I did mean to ask you about that, actually. I mean, if you have time, do you want to just give a quick summary of what you're working on there?
Sure, sure. Basically, you know, one of the biggest challenges we faced when we were launching the hedge fund was we had spent over a shameful amount of money, over $1 million on data and infrastructure. And we feel like that barrier to entry is way too high. We want to lower that barrier for other folks out there. And just so you know, this has nothing to do with Domeyard. We're completely unaffiliated. You know, that we're not front running. You know, Domeyard's not taking that data at all from anybody. So it's a completely different venture. But basically just offering, you know, data that's a lot. It's the quality that we expect from, you know, institution quality data. But we sell it a la carte. So it's broken down. You can buy literally just one security if you wanted to, or, you know, the entire thing if you wanted to. But the goal is, like, we make it a lot cheaper for folks and lower that barrier to entry. So it's called Data Bento, if anyone's ever curious, like bento as in the bento box. And the goal is, like, you know, people can purchase data from various different sources. And it's, we do live and historical. So you can have live data feeds from various different sources, but in smaller chunks than what we typically see in the market. So yeah, that's it's been fun to work on that. For me, it's meaningful because, you know, I've been spending, people always ask me questions about morality, like, you know, you're an HFT, right? Like, how immoral can you be? And I've always wanted to do something that hopefully would bring some value to the industry and have some meaning. And so for me, Data Bento has been fantastic in terms of bringing that kind of value. And I'm very lucky to, you know, be able to have, you know, to have the hedge fund reach a stage where I can be more hands-off now, and that we have a team, and that, you know, the team is fantastic to kind of take over a lot of the day-to-day, you know, operations and things that I didn't want to do as much. So, so that's been very lucky. And then, you know, to be able to start this data venture and hopefully help people out, that's been a dream come true for me.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. I'll make sure to include a link to that in the show notes. And if someone wants to find out more about Domeyard, what's the website?
It's just domeyard.com.
Okay, nice and easy.
Yeah, just so people know, we were named after the MIT Dome and Harvard Yard back then. We didn't want to name the fund after ourselves. And then by coincidence, the .com was, you know, pretty much free. So we were able to snag that pretty quickly and got pretty lucky with the name.
Nice. Well, Christina, very grateful for your time. Really appreciate you doing this. Thank you very much. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Aaron. It's been an honor.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.